Usually when I see a group of nurses, I'm about to be knocked out and put under the knife. So this is way better. There's no doubt about that. I have three kids. My daughter, Kelsey, was 4 years old when I retired from football, which was in 1994. She loved it. I was with her all the time. I'd take her to the park. I'd take her to Chuck E. Cheese. I'd take her to the mountains to go hiking. This went on for almost a month of every day I was doing stuff with Kelsey, and then I got that dreaded letter in the mailbox that said I had jury duty. And not only did I go sit for the jury, but I got selected for the jury, and I had a week-long jury trial that I was involved in. And Kelsey didn't understand it. She was really concerned. What happened to Dad? Maybe I got another job, God forbid. She'd wait at the door for me, and when I got home, she would just, you know, grab onto me. Where have you been, Dad? What you doing? And I tried to explain to her what jury duty was, and, you know, a four-year-old doesn't understand what a civic responsibility is. Finally, though, I think it was on Thursday, the day before the trial ended, Kelsey met me at the door with her arms crossed and looked at me and said, Dad, if you're going to the mountains again tomorrow, take me with you. She thought I had jerky duty. In the mountains of Colorado, on the road, there's this white van that sits there with a big sign, elk jerky, beef jerky for sale, right? And there's the chainsaw bears, too, right? She thought I was up there in the white van in the mountains selling jerky. So if I use any football terms and sound like jerky duty to you, stop me. I'm pretty good about it, but stop me and let me know. Or you can email me at carl@carlmecklenburg.com, and I'll have to have feedback. So I'd appreciate that if you did that anyway. I don't know, did anybody watch the Green Bay game this last, yeah. It was cold and snowy, it was like 20 below, and then snow blowing around. And it was a miserable day to play football. But a lot of funny things happen in football, especially when the field's frozen like that and then people's hands are frozen. And there was one play where the ball was fumbled by about three guys. And they used to have these old films called Football Follies. That are fine. They're plays like that there's music set to the background, and it's hilarious stuff. But the craziest play I ever saw in football happened on a dry field. It was a Mile High Stadium. It was in 1985. And the Denver Broncos were playing the Seattle Seahawks. Seattle had the football. In 1985, I was just a defensive end who went in on passing situations. So I'd go in on third down if it was third and long, and I'd be a pass rusher. The rest of the time, I stood on the sidelines and watched the game. I was on the sidelines during this play, and I was standing there, and I was standing behind the ball boy. It was a new kid, a kid who I'd never seen as a ball boy, and he actually looked kind of young. He was 13, 14 years old, and usually ball boys are 18, 19 years old. But he was excited. He had his ball, he had his towel, and like I said, it was a dry field, a dry day. He had the towel, and he was polishing the ball anyway. He was fired up to be there. But he was there because he was the son of the general manager. John Beek was a general manager. This was Chip Beek, his son. And Chip was out of his mind happy. So I'm standing behind Chip, and this play unfolded in front of me. Seattle ran the ball towards our south end zone. Their old left-handed quarterback, Jim Zorn, who I think just got hired by Washington Redskins as offensive coordinator. But he pitched the ball back to their running back, a guy named Kurt Warner. And Kurt started running a sweep towards our sideline, towards myself and towards Chip Beek. Now, we had this strong safety named Dennis Smith, who was a big, big hitter. And Dennis came up out of the secondary and hit Kurt Warner the way only Dennis Smith could hit somebody. And Kurt went flying to the north, but the ball kept rolling west towards our sidelines, towards myself and Chip. Now, anytime the ball's loose on a Sunday afternoon on a football field, it attracts a crowd of guys my size and bigger, running as fast as they can. It's like a stampede, running right after that ball, running right at Chip. And Chip lost his nerve. And as he turned to run away, he dropped that ball he had just been lovingly polishing. And it hit him on the heel, and it rolled out on the field about 10 feet from the other ball. Now, Tom Jackson was also involved in this play. Tom was our weak side linebacker. So he'd line up outside of the tackle on the weak side. And he had a set of rules when he was a blitzing linebacker. The call was a will shoot, which meant he was blitzing. First of all, he had to get up as tight to the ball as he could. He had to widen his stance a little bit so he'd be outside the tackle and he could get through. Then he was supposed to penetrate the line of scrimmage, get as deep as the football, and check for a bootleg, which is a quarterback faking one way and then spinning back out against the grain. Check for a reverse, which is a wide receiver coming back against the grain, and then follow the ball and look for the fumble. Well, Tom did his job just right. He got through that line of scrimmage, checked bootleg, checked reverse, and he was the first one of the big scary guys to get on the ball. Then all the rest of them piled on top the way they do. Steve Largent was also involved in this play. You might know Steve out here in D.C. He was a congressman, a great man, a Christian man. I've got all kinds of respect for him. There you go. But he's a guy that really was a pest on the football field. And he was doing what he did best out there. He was being a pest. He tries to block linebackers, and he's only about this tall. And you throw him out of the way, and he's right back on you like a little gnat. So he was out there doing his gnat thing, and he turned around, and he saw a pile of guys and a ball lying next to it. Chip ball. So he ran over there, and he got on that ball, and some guys from this pile got over there and got on top of him. The ref was also involved in this play, obviously. So the ref ran up next to both piles, and he had seen everything. He saw the big hit, he saw the fumble, he saw Chip panic, he saw the two balls, he saw Tom get on this one, Largent get on that one, guys switching piles. He ran over next to both and said, "Broncos ball." Now, like I said, Steve Largent is a Christian man, but that's as close to cussing as I ever heard out of Steve. He came out of that pile, and he held the ball right in front of the ref's face and said, "How can it be the Broncos' ball? I have the blankety blank blank ball." It's a funny story, but there's a reason I tell it. Success won't happen by accident. It won't bounce off of a ball boy's foot and roll to you. There's a pattern. There's a template to success. Just like Tom had a set of rules to follow, and he was successful. And I call it my 6 keys to success. That's teamwork, courage, dedication, desire, honesty and forgiveness, and goal setting. And it doesn't matter what order I put them in, because they're interrelated and interdependent. Everyone relies on the other one. And you can't choose half of them and be halfway successful. It doesn't work out that way. You need them all. First one I'm going to start with is desire. And I think that's appropriate, just because without desire, without a target, without a passion, without a mission, you're going to have a hard time being successful. A desire is a dream, a passion, a mission. It's extravagant, there's no time attached to it, and it's somewhat general. My oldest child, Luke, just graduated from Wesleyan University. We're very proud of him, but when Luke was 4 years old, Toys R Us just came to Denver. What a dream come true for that young man. Now, they advertised like mad. There was a big blitz. I swear the boy thought he was going to see the giraffe when he went down there. He had been in other stores where there was two or three aisles of toys, but this was a whole warehouse full of toys, and he begged me and begged me, "Please, Dad, bring me down to the grand opening of Toys R Us." He said it in kind of a reverent tone, "Toys R Us." So I brought him down there, and we went through every single aisle of that store, back and forth and back and forth. I think he picked up some shopping tips from his mother. But we ended up in the costume aisle. Not the one that they just broke down, the one that they have for Halloween, but the one that's always there. You've seen it. It's got a nurse's costume in it. Certainly does. Got a doctor's costume. Doctor's costume's got one of those mirrors you wear on your head, you know, stethoscope, the bag with the reflex hammer. Kids love that thing. The syringe you can give a horse a shot with, right? That's in the bag, too. Anyway, Luke goes under the bottom shelf and pulls out a toy and says, "Dad, I found it. This is it. This is what I want." My son had pulled out the McDonald's drive-thru guy card. You got the visor with the golden arches on it. You got a real McDonald's bag with a rubber Big Mac in it, meal number one, right? He even had the plastic stand with the microphone so he could talk to the people driving through. And he was excited. He really wanted that thing. I couldn't do it. I couldn't let him bring it home. Because I know if you set your desire, if you set your passion, if you set your mission here, that's all the farther you're going to get. I didn't want my son dreaming of being the McDonald's drive-thru guy, that was the best thing in the world. We brought home the doctor costume, what can I say? And this would be a perfect story if he became a doctor, but he found his passion elsewhere. He found his passion in music. He went to one of the best music schools in the country and got a degree from there, and he's going on at this point. So I'm very proud of him, and I like to think that maybe that little shove away from the McDonald's drive-thru guy thing helped out. I went to 12 training camps in the NFL. And training camp is brutal. It's really tough. And what made it tougher for me is that I was a jinx. If you were my roommate, you were going to be fired or hurt, and it was going to happen in a hurry. And I still have no idea why. But it became apparent to the other guys that you don't want to room with Carl. So the way training camp is arranged it for the Broncos down there in Greeley is they've got a bunch of different suites, and then they've got a row of single rooms in the front. And the single rooms are usually reserved for the guys who have 9, 10, 11 years of seniority with the team, and they get the option if they want a single room, if they want a room with someone else. Carl had a single room in his third year with the Broncos because no one would room with me. So I sit in my single room by myself. I'd sit at the desk and tie flies or play guitar or do something in between practices, and I'd see guys coming and going out the front window to the parking lot, and usually they were going out to the bars to, you know, blow off some steam, or they'd be carrying their luggage and going to the laundromat, or they'd be going to the grocery store. But every once in a while, once or twice a year, I'd see someone going out carrying their pillow and their luggage. And anytime they were carrying their pillow, I knew we had what we called a runner. A runner is someone who gave up, who quit, who left without the coach even telling them to leave. Usually in the NFL, there's cut-down days. There's 10, 11, 12 guys who are fired at once. But if you ever see one guy fired at once, usually that means he's a runner. And what that means is his passion, his mission, his desire was, I want to go to an NFL training camp. It wasn't, I want to be the best player that ever played football. Don't sell yourself short. Set your mission, set your desire, set your passion high. And you're going to have a chance to reach that. If you keep it low, you're just limiting yourself. Believe in yourself. Those opportunities are out there, and you can be successful in whatever you try to do, as long as you don't sell yourself short. And it doesn't matter how old you are. I heard that median age. I'm sneaking up on that. It doesn't matter how old you are. My wife has an uncle passed away a couple years ago with Uncle Carl. Happens to be named Carl just like me, but Uncle Carl ran a flower shop. He ran this flower shop for years. He opened it every day. He closed every day, 6 days a week, years and years and years. He got 65 years old and he decided it's time to sell the flower shop and retire. So he sells the flower shop, goes home, watches Oprah for a couple of days. That's all he can stand. So he decides he's got to do something with himself, so he goes down to the local senior center and asks the gal behind the desk, you know, what guys my age do down here? What, is there anything starting up that I can do? And she said, well, you know what, there's actually a carving class that's just starting out, and lots of gentlemen your age are signing up for it. Maybe you'd like to try that. So he signed up for that, and it was a wood carving class, and they were carving animals and birds and fish and stuff like that. So Carl's down there, and their first project is carving some ducks, like a duck decoy. And he's down there and he's carving and he's working on it. And he actually did a really good job. He did such a good job that they decided to display it in the front window of this senior center. And he was hanging out there one day and a gal came by and looked in and said, "Wow, look at that duck." She came inside, she asked the receptionist, "Who made that duck? I'm very interested in purchasing it." Now, Carl happened to be sitting right there, and he said, "Oh, that's my duck." And she said, "I'll give you $500 for that duck." Now, he's thinking, that's a lot of flowers. This sold. And he went on and he worked at this thing and he developed such a skill and a talent, and it was there inside of him, but he developed it, and he was one of the up-and-coming carvers in Minnesota. People would commission him to come in and carve their a likeness of their beloved pet, or if there was a place in their house where they wanted to have some cattails and or whatever they wanted carved, he would go in and be commissioned to do these carvings. And it was a wonderful thing that he had no idea he had that skill or that talent. Now, I wasn't always a great football player. Actually, Dad knows, he saw most of it, but I was a little stiff kind of kid. If you ask my peewee coaches what they remember most about me, they'd say Carl was the stiffest player we've ever seen. It's, everyone else is touching their toes. Carl, I'm about to my knees. I was not a great player. I got cut from baseball in high school. I got cut from basketball in high school. As a junior in high school, I played JV football. I didn't even make the varsity team. But I always loved it. It was a passion inside of me. There was something about that game that I loved to play. So I just kept playing. I was just one of the guys, but I kept playing. As a senior in high school, I made All-State. And I played every down, and I played on offense and defense. And it was great fun. But if you can imagine this, I was considered too small to play major college football. Because I was only 6 foot and 200 pounds at that time. I grew 3 inches and 40 pounds in college. So I went to Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Any Augustana Vikings in the house? Is there one? It's a big nursing school. All right, that's the first time ever. I went there on a one-third scholarship with the understanding if I played well, they'd give me a full scholarship. And the full scholarship was important not only from a financial standpoint, but if you're a full scholarship player, they treat you differently. The coaches treat you differently, and the other players treat you differently. So I was there, and I worked real hard, did everything I possibly could. My second year there, I led the team in sacks. I played every down on defense. I thought I was going to get the full scholarship. Coach called me into his office and sat me down and said, "Carl, we know your dad's a doctor, and he can afford this school. So we're going to take away your one-third scholarship, and we're going to use it to bring someone else in." Now, I love football. That was my passion, along with a number of other things, but that was one of my passions. My desire was to play football, but I wasn't going to play it there anymore. So I left Augustana College and walked on at the University of Minnesota. Now, there are times when you have to change direction. If your desire and your passion is here, and mine was to play football at Augustana College. But desire and goal setting are two sides of a similar coin. Say, in desire, I told you it's extravagant, there's no time connected to it, and it's general. Well, goal setting, goals are reasonable. They're short-term and they're specific. Two sides of the same coin. So what I did is I set a goal that I was going to be a starter for the Minnesota Gophers, and I was going to leave Augustana College, which is a Division II school, a real small school, and go to this Big Ten school and make a name for myself. And it was important to me, and I worked really hard at it, but when you transfer between four-year colleges, you have to sit out for a year. They say you're ineligible. You're ineligible to play in games, but you're not ineligible to practice. So basically, my job was I was a live blocking dummy for a year. I worked hard at it. I was in the weight room. I was doing everything I possibly could from that standpoint and was a real good live blocking dummy. And by the time I was eligible for a scholarship, they finally gave me one. Man, that felt good. That's something I had worked for year after year after year after year. Finally, I got that to that point. And then we played our spring game a week later. Spring game is an inter-squad scrimmage that every major college has. And I tore a ligament in my knee. And as I lay in the hospital, a coach came to me and said, "Carl, we want you to give the scholarship back." Have you been there? Where you're struggling and fought and worked and finally got something and somebody pulls the rug out from under you? Don't give up. Don't quit. That's the difference between successful organizations and those that aren't. That's the difference between successful people and those that aren't. To me, success is overcoming obstacles on the way to your dreams. And if you're not bumping into obstacles, you're not pushing. You should run into trouble in your life. It's part of the experience. And that's the only way you can find out what you're capable of and what your limits are, is by bumping into obstacles and overcoming them. That was my scholarship. I had worked really hard for that scholarship. I knew I was the best defensive player that team had. I'd been at practice for a year and watched. I wasn't going to give it back. And it got so bad that they, instead of allowing me to rehab my knee in the men's training room, in an effort to get me to quit, they had me rehab my knee in the women's training room. What were they thinking? I'm a 21-year-old boy. There was no place I would have run. That's still my good knee. Well, anyway, I went on, and the next year, I led the Big Ten in sacks, and there was no question whether I belonged on that team or not. But don't give up. Don't quit. If it's important to you, if it's a passion, if it's a desire, set some goals in that direction and don't stop. And you'll have an opportunity to be successful. I played linebacker for the first time in my third year in the NFL. It was a strange situation. I started off as a defensive lineman. That's why I was number 77 in the Broncos. That's a lineman's number. But they kept switching my numbers as a rookie. I was a 12th round draft pick, which means basically I was an afterthought. I was the 310th guy picked in the draft. Now they only have 7 rounds in the draft. So they didn't expect me to make it. So they gave me the number of a starter. When you first come in, they gave me a number of a starter. But after the first week, it looked like I could maybe make the team, so they gave me another number of somebody who was a backup. And then they fired somebody and gave me number 77, so that was it. That was my number. And I got to hang on to that. And then when they tried to switch me to linebacker, they tried to switch my number again, but I said my parents couldn't find me on the field if they ever did it again. So I kept that number. But anyway, playing linebacker is very different than playing defensive line. There's lots of different skills involved. You stand up, you got to move backwards, and you never do that as a lineman on purpose. So it was a tough adjustment for me, and the coaches came to me and said, we think you could help us on not just pass rushing downs, but we think you could help us on first and second down, on run downs too, if you make this switch. Now, I'd only been around for a couple of years, but I had already seen guys fired when they switch positions. It's not an easy thing to do. And when they do that, generally that means they're unhappy about something else that you're doing. But I thought I'd give it a shot. And I worked at it, and I trained at it, and I did everything I possibly could. And the 10th game of that year, we played the Oakland Raiders in Mile High Stadium. And for those of you who aren't from the Colorado area, that is the big game of the year for us. That's it. That's when the Washington Redskins play the Dallas Cowboys. It's that same kind of rivalry, and it usually determines who wins the division. It was a big thing, and I got to start in that game. Never played linebacker before in my life, but I had a play in that game that they still show on highlight films. I had a big hit on Marcus Allen. The Fox Sports Channel, they have a show called The Sports List. They listed that as one of the top 10 hits in NFL history. Didn't have any idea what I was doing, but I made this hit. The crowd went crazy, and I was a starting linebacker. I knew at that point I was a linebacker, and the talent was there inside of me, but I had to have the courage to try something new. Now, the courage to try something new is a very difficult thing. But it was something that you have to be successful and find out where your talents and your skills lie. I played 6 games that year as a linebacker. The 7th one was in the Pro Bowl as an all-pro linebacker. Never done it before in my life. See, I'm a Christian, and I believe God's given each and every one of us more talent and skill than we can possibly use. It's there, locked up inside of you, but along with that, you've been given free will. What that means is it's up to you to go out, find out where those skills and talents lie, develop them, and then you've got a chance to be successful. So playing linebacker was something that came very late to me in life. Another courage that's important for success is the courage to be decisive. And I know as nurses you face that all the time in your job. You have to be decisive. You have to trust your training and be decisive. For those of you who know anything about football, I run a 4.9 40. That's not very fast. That's why I was a lineman. I ran a 4.9 40. But what I found was if I took the first step before the other people in the right direction, all the angles changed in my favor. I'm sure you find the same thing in nursing, and you'll find the same thing in any other leadership position you're in, that if you trust your training, anticipate problems, evaluate what's going on at the time, and respond as quickly as you possibly can, you're going to have a chance to be successful. Even if maybe somehow you're not the most talented as everyone around you, you still will be successful if you take that first step in the right direction. Every year in training camp, players have come in, and I'd watch them, and I'd know they knew what the play was going to be, but they had to look again, and by that time it was too late. The same thing goes on in life. The same thing goes on in business. If you're a businessman, and you take the first step before the other guys, and it's in the right direction, you're going to be successful. Same thing in what you do. So have the courage to be decisive. Trust your training. Believe in yourself, and you'll have the opportunity to be successful. I played with Shannon Sharp for, 6 years. Shannon was funny. Shannon came from backwoods Georgia. He came into the Broncos camp out of shape, had this crazy buckwheat hair thing going, was missing about 5 teeth. I mean, just a rough-looking character, had no idea what he was doing blocking, but he could always catch a ball. Now, he developed into one of the best blocking and receiving all-around tight ends that there ever was in the NFL. And he did that because of his unbelievable work ethic. To me, dedication is hard work, constant learning, and refusing to quit. Now, you heard about my background in the refusing to quit, the hard work that I put in to be successful. Well, Shannon did the same thing. That hard work, that work ethic carried him a long way. He told me a story about he and his brother Sterling, who's an all-pro receiver for Green Bay for many years, and their situation when they grew up. They grew up in the backwoods, Georgia area where there's all kinds of chicken farms. And they're these little low, well, actually they're not small. They're pretty big, but they're really low buildings. And they let the chickens out during the day, and they run around and do whatever chickens do during the day. And then at night, they come back into these barns, and they shut them in the barn so they'd be all right in there and not have the foxes and coyotes or whatever get them. And if they wanted to send them off to market, they'd hire the local kids to go in these barns and catch the chickens and load them up onto the truck. So Shannon and Sterling, growing up in a poor family, if they wanted to have a piece of candy, have some pop, or whatever they wanted to buy, they had to get that money themselves. So Shannon and Sterling would run around. They got a nickel a bird. Shannon said they were in there, bird, 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 bird. Catch all these birds. I know he caught a lot of birds because his teeth were rotten. There was plenty of candy going in his mouth. He thought he was getting a nickel a bird. But what he was doing was he was developing unbelievable hand-eye coordination and lateral quickness that he brought with him to the NFL, along with toughness and intelligence and some other things, and became one of the greatest receivers to ever play. So maybe you're not doing exactly what you want to do right now. You can't chase your passion, right now. But wherever you are, work hard. Because you're going to develop skills and talents and abilities that are going to carry you on in the future and allow you to be successful. For me, it was playing hockey. I grew up in Minnesota, and Minnesota, everybody skates. I mean, that's half the year, there's nothing, not a lot else to do, really. So I was skating all the time, and I loved it. It was fun, and I was having great fun, but what I was really doing was that I was developing strength between here and here that I was able to use when they switched me to linebacker. See, as a defensive lineman, you're down in a three-point stance like this, and you're coming forward all the time. As a linebacker, you're up like this, and you've got to be able to drop out like this. You've got to be able to move laterally like this. I already had that ability because of all the skating I did as a kid. Not because I thought I was going to be a linebacker, but just because I worked hard at it because it was fun and it was important to me. So wherever you're at, work hard at those things, and you're going to have a chance to be successful down the line. When I retired from football in 1994, I was a little bit concerned about what I was going to do. I've got a degree in biology that I had gotten 12 years earlier. With the intent, I had taken the MCAT test and was going to go to medical school, but I wasn't. At that point, I already had children, and I didn't want to leave and go to medical school. I thought that'd be too much. So I was looking at my resume, and there wasn't a lot there. I mean, I could be a football coach, or I could be a bouncer. That's what I was looking at. But my wife realized that the money was going to stop coming in, so she had been doing a lot of remodeling. She was kind of like a squirrel before winter, you know. She was very busy. There was a lot of stuff going on in the house, and I'd watch these guys coming in and with their crews and what they were doing, and it became very apparent to me that if I worked hard, if I did what I said I was going to do, and if I was somewhat polite, I could rise right to the top of the remodeling business. That was very reassuring to me, believe me. Character, accountability, morality, these are all parts of my honesty and forgiveness key. See, in the NFL, they film everything. They film practices. They film games from two different angles. And now they even film meetings, is my understanding. So theoretically, you could sit in a meeting watching film of yourself, practicing. Everything is on film. And you'll sit in a meeting room with your peers. And they'll have a big screen, not quite this big, but a big screen up front, and the coach will run everything back and forth and back and forth, and he'll say something like, and this is a little bit technical, but you'll understand what I'm saying when I finish. Mecklenburg, it's a two-deep zone, and the tight end's running wide open down the middle of the field. You got to cover him. That's your guy. And I can see it. It's right in front of me on film, and still my natural tendency as a human being is to say, that's not my fault. Coach, the defensive end should hit him so he can't get off the line of scrimmage so quickly. And the outside linebacker is supposed to squeeze him into me so I can cover him easier. And the strong safety, when he runs deep like that, he should be over the top. He shouldn't be helping out the cornerback over there on the wide receiver. Coach, it's not my fault. But what should I say? Yeah, that's my guy. That's my guy. And you know what? That's my guy, and I'll get him next time. See, the first part of honesty and forgiveness is being honest with yourself. And then when something doesn't quite go right, to forgive yourself. My first speaking engagement was in 1983. My rookie year, and the Broncos have made the playoffs for the first time in a long time. And I grew up in Minnesota. In Minnesota, the Vikings make the playoffs, and people are like, let's see how they do. I mean, they're very stoic. The Broncos made the playoffs, and people were naming their children John Elway. They were painting their houses orange. It was mayhem. It was craziness. Well, the Museum of Natural History decided to take advantage of this mayhem, and they held a pep rally just to see if they could get some Bronco fans in there who hadn't been there before. And they called the Broncos, and the Broncos assigned myself and Sammy Winder to go down. Sammy was our running back at the time, to go down and speak at this thing. Now, I had never done that, and I was a little bit nervous about it, but I thought I'd give it a shot. So we were down there, and this area of town has all these one-way streets, and I don't know, downtown D.C. is kind of like this. There's like those circle things, and you can get lost really easy. So I'm down there, and I got turned around, and I got to the museum just when things were supposed to start. And as I walked in the door, Sammy and the lady in charge of this thing were heading down to the room where the pep rally was to be held. And I fell in line with Sammy and said, "Sammy, what's going to happen? How's this going to work?" And Sammy said, "Carl, here's the deal. I'll get up. I'll talk about the offense. You get up. You talk about the defense." And we were playing the Seahawks again. I don't know why all my stories are about the Seahawks, but this lady here is going to hand us a Seahawk, and we're supposed to tear it up. I figured I could do that. So Sammy gets up, and he starts talking about how Elway is going to throw the ball and how he's going to run the ball and how many points we're going to score, and the fans are getting worked up. I'm thinking, hey, this is all right. It's a good group. I can handle these guys. So it's my turn, and I get up and I talk about how I'm going to sack the quarterback, and Randy Granishar is going to tackle their running back, and how we're going to shut them down, and the fans are even more worked up. And then it's time for the Seahawks. So the lady hands Sammy this bird, and Sammy holds it up over his head and says, "Carl, you're the defensive player. You tear it up," and gives it to me. You've all been to the Museum of Natural History in one form or another before, I would expect. It's kind of like Smithsonian, or I mean, all these. They're very similar. They've got these dioramas with these beautifully mounted specimens. In their natural environment, you know, there's the vegetation, there's the little animals that live in there, the rodents and stuff. There's even the bugs. I mean, they got everything. It looks like it's night at the museum. It's just going to come alive, right? Well, this bird wasn't anything like that. This bird's wings were pinned down to its side. Feathers were sticking out. Felt kind of crunchy in my hands. I figured they don't need this thing. So I got it by its leg. Did I tell you I'm from Minnesota? In Minnesota, if someone says tear it up, they mean tear it up, right? Well, Sammy's from Mississippi. And I found out later that in Mississippi Ebonics, tear it up can mean like tear up the town, tear up the dance floor. I got this bird by its leg. I tear it in half, feathers are flying, stuffing's going everywhere, I tear the head off the other half, I threw it out in the crowd goes crazy, I love public speaking, this is for me! Until I turned around and saw the lady in charge of this thing. She got her head in her hand. She can't believe what I've just done. The Seahawk was actually an osprey. And it was part of an ongoing study of the osprey species. And this particular osprey was collected in 1910. My dad read about it in the USA Today. As I left the museum, they were announcing, "Whoever caught the head of the Seahawk, please bring it back. We'll give you free passes to the IMAX theater." That's the courage to try new things. Even though they might go terribly wrong. Because sometimes things go wrong, but you know what? I had the courage to do it again. And do it again, and do it again, and now it is what I do for a living, and I love it. Don't give up. Don't quit. If it's important to you, stick in there. Have the courage to try new things. And then have the courage to stick with them if you like it. I played on some great Bronco teams through the years. I love this. Many voices, one mission. That's a team. That's what that is. Many voices, one mission. And I played on some great teams through the years. I played in 3 Super Bowls. And it was awesome to go to work when we were many voices and we had one mission, and that was to win. It was awesome. They're still some of the best friends I've ever met in my life. I see them once a year at our alumni game, and coming back together with those guys, we pick up right where we left off. It's probably similar when you people come back together for meetings when you've been here 20-some years. It's the same kind of thing. If you have that kind of shared passion, that teamwork, you're going to have a chance to accomplish great things, just like A1's accomplishing, with you as leaders. I mean, leadership, to me, is the highest expression of teamwork. So I played on these Bronco teams, and the old guys got along with the young guys, and the coaches got along with the players, and the offense got along with the defense, and it was really, really wonderful to go to work. And I played on some bad teams, too. My last year there, we were 6-10. And it was a horrible year. It was Wade Phillips last year as the coach of the Broncos. And we had a group of people that stood behind our bench at every game, every home game, and chanted, "Wade must go. Wade must go." I mean, it was miserable. And the offense didn't get along with the defense. And the black guys didn't get along with the white guys. And the rich guys didn't get along with the richer guys. I like that one, too. But it really was hard to go to work because we didn't have that shared mission. Everybody was thinking about themselves, and it was very, very, very difficult to be successful. And the funny thing was, there wasn't that many different guys. The changes were very subtle. You know, you lose somebody here, you add somebody there, and all of a sudden, you're not a team. You're individuals. See, I think of a team as a seesaw or a teeter-totter, and on one side you have the leaders, like we have in this room. The leaders who think we instead of me. The leaders who think long-term instead of short-term. The leaders that have that shared goal and mission in mind, and that's where they're headed. On the other side, you've got the egos. There's a few of them in the NFL, believe me. And the egos think only about themselves and in the short term. They could care less about the team. And in the middle is most of the rest of the people who could kind of go either way. Now, by adding or subtracting somebody as a leader or as an ego, you can tip that teeter-totter or seesaw one way or the other, and you're going to have momentum towards failure, or you're going to have momentum towards success. That's how one individual can make a huge difference in an organization, in a team. If you step out of that middle group, or if you can convince someone as a leader to step out of that middle group and join the leaders and think long term and think of the passion or the mission of your organization, you're going to have a chance to be successful. I heard Barbara say that your mission is promoting the health of women and children. If you think about that when you're making decisions, if you think about that at work, every time you're dealing with individuals, you're going to have a chance to be successful if you're all headed in that same direction. That sort of passion, that sort of mission is what will carry you forward, not only as an association, but will carry you forward in your individual work environment. If you can convey that and convince other people in your organization to jump on board and be a leader, not be somebody in the middle there, so much the better. You're all going to move forward, and you're going to move forward at a faster rate. It's very obvious in sports. If you look at the New England Patriots, they've been great for a long time, other than the fact that they cheat. But what makes them great? What? Not that they cheat. I played 12 years in the NFL and we never lost to New England. But right now they're a great team, and they're a great team because they all know their role and they function as a team. They're not the best talent. There's no doubt they're not the best talent. There's more talented teams in the league, and you can just look at Pro Bowl rosters and see that. Did you notice talent wasn't one of my 6 keys to success? Because it's universal. It's out there. It's just what you do with your talent. And what they do with their talent is they win football games. Everybody has a job. Everybody does it. They work side by side. They're committed to each other. They're committed to the goal of the team. And they're successful. And you can contrast that with the last, remember that U.S. Dream Team in basketball? Yeah, that was bad. That was really bad. They had unbelievable talent, but it was all going its own direction. They lost to Lithuania. They lost to Puerto Rico. That's part of the United States. And they lost because they weren't a team. And they weren't a team because they didn't have leaders, as many as they had egos. And they didn't have leaders who were cared enough about the mission of the team to bring others in and make them leaders too. And I know you have a drive to bring people into A1 and to make them leaders. And that's why. If you can bring more people into A1 and get them interested in what's going on and get them trained and get them excited about their jobs, their livelihoods, as well as your own, all of a sudden you've got that mass of leaders and you're going to have momentum towards success wherever you're working. So that's how leadership works in the NFL, and it's how leadership works where you are too. I see leadership as 4 C's, as in the letter C. Community. And what I mean by community is knowing your team. If you're a good leader, you know the strengths and the weaknesses of everyone on your team. You have an intimate relationship with them. You know them, you know their families, you know what's going on in their lives. It's important to you. That community piece, to me, is number one in being a good leader. You can't be a leader if you don't know your team. Because to be a leader, you have to be able to use the team to cover for the weaknesses of the members of the team and use the strengths of the individuals to strengthen the team and to help out with what's going on. And you'll accomplish so much more than you can as a group of individuals. The other thing is commitment. And clarity and consistency of that commitment. Those are the 4 C's. Community, commitment, clarity, and consistency. Clarity brings in communication too, but it should be obvious that the most important thing to you is that mission, that passion of your team. And if that is consistently shown over a long period of time and in different situations, you're a leader. There are many different kinds of leaders. But with those 4 C's, you are a leader. I got a little bit of time to open up the floor for questions. Does anybody have a question for me? I've got one more story I'm going to tell you about John Elway. Yes?
I would like to know what that presenter wanted you to do with the Seahawks.
I would like to know that too. The question was, what was I supposed to do with the Seahawks? I think I was just supposed to wrestle around and mess around with it and pretend we were beating it up, I guess. It may have been a, yes.
There are Seahawks fans
in the room. They're still around. And that was always a big... That was always a big challenge. The Seahawks did better than the Broncos this year. I know that. Yeah. Any other questions? Nobody wants to know what I bench press or what kind of car I drive. None of that. Oh, yes. Yeah. Teamwork. Courage. And that includes the courage to try new things and the courage to be decisive. Dedication, which is hard work, constant learning, and refusing to quit. Desire to dream, your passion, your mission. Honesty and forgiveness. And goal setting. And goal settings are the little steps that you can aim yourself. See, I've heard speakers say you have to set yearly, quarterly, monthly, weekly, daily goals and write them all down. To me, part of my definition of a goal is that it's reasonable, and that's not reasonable to me. I can't do that. But what I can do is when I find myself drifting away from my mission or my desire or my passion, to set goals to point me back in that direction. Or if it changes, like for me, my biggest desire and passion was to be the greatest football player that ever played, then I retired. That was gone. Now, as a motivational speaker, I want to inspire long-term positive change in teams and individuals. That's my passion. That's my desire. So that's the way I use goals. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm a big believer in affirmations. You know, you can reprogram your mind about yourself and dig deep enough to do what you really can do.
Yeah.
But you have to reaffirm it for yourself, and you can have to talk yourself into believing in yourself that way. Do you see a lot of affirmations occur in football, or do you ever practice it yourself?
The affirmation thing is important, and you have to be able to believe in yourself, because the coaches don't do a whole lot of affirmation. they break you down, and that's part of it, is understand, being honest with yourself and saying, yeah, I have this strength. And a lot of people have a hard time with that. They'll run into a situation where they make a mistake, something goes wrong, and they can't forgive themselves and move on and say, you know, I'm okay. That's part of that honesty and forgiveness thing. In the NFL, if you grade out 90%, and they grade every football play in a game, both on technique and on assignment, if you grade out 90%, you're an all-pro player. Now, that means 10% of the time, that coach is screaming at you right in front of your peers. And you develop a thick skin that way, but you also develop the ability to say, you know what, I'm okay. I see this happen to everybody else. I'm learning here. And I can forgive myself and move on and get better. So that affirmation thing, we used to call it just rehearsing in your mind. I mean, basically, you go over the plays in your mind over and over and over, and then you know how to react. And if you react properly in your mind, you're going to react properly with your body, too. Any other questions? I thought I saw one back here.
You started with desire, and you wanted to be successful. I have a high school senior, but I'm going to give you this test talk about it.
I've got a book coming out this year that will have all this in it. So it's going to be called The Heart of a Student Athlete. And the subtitle is going to be, I'm thinking. I'm negotiating with this, but it's going to be all-pro advice for competitors and their families. And it's a great message for people, and especially for young people who are trying to believe in themselves and get through all the challenges that they face. I just spoke 2 days ago in Baltimore at McDonough School, for those of you who know that school. But it's something that I do every time when I got this opportunity. I call around the local schools and see if anybody else or any of the schools will have me in to talk. Yes. Did they encourage me to have a backup is the question to football? Because I'm telling you what, the percentages are horrible for anybody who thinks when they're in high school that they're going to be a professional athlete. I didn't need that. I actually didn't even think about being a professional football player until I got to college. And then when I got to college, I was a pre-med student. And I took the entrance exam to medical school and scored high enough that I could have gone to medical school. And you know what, that first training camp, that was an unbelievable advantage for me. I had this opportunity to play professional football, which is a dream come true for me. But I also, if I didn't make the team, I wasn't going to be working at 7-Eleven or digging ditches or whatever. I didn't have that pressure. I could just play. And it really, I think, helped me in many, many ways. The other thing is there was 110 different defenses in our scheme, and every single one of them had adjustments depending on what the other team did. And it was actually once the ball was snapped a lot of times, then we had to change and make adjustments. So learning how to learn like I did in high school and in college by taking hard classes and working the way I worked in school allowed me to be successful in the NFL. I wasn't going to be the best athlete out there. I never was going to be. That's why I was the 310th guy picked in the draft. They can measure how big you are. They can measure how fast you are, how high you jump, but they can't measure how quickly you're going to absorb the material they give you at that first training camp. And if you can't do that, it doesn't matter how big, fast, strong you are. If you don't know where you're going, you're not going to get there. So that allowed me to be successful is that whole training I had in school and learning how to learn. Yes?
You talk a lot about forgiveness. And no disrespect to your profession, when you make a mistake, so you die.
That's true.
And when we make errors, unfortunately, the outcomes are not always good. We are trying to move the healthcare into a no-blame situation, looking not just at the individual, but looking at the system that led up. How do you help nurses, as leaders that we are, to forgive themselves?
That's a tough half. Yeah, and I think everybody heard that question. It's, forgiveness is one of the toughest things. There's no doubt about it. There is something paralyzing about making a mistake and having everyone else know it. But after all, we're human. And mistakes happen, things happen that are out of our control. To me, as a leader, you should be able to say, I've been in this situation before. I know people who have made mistakes. I've made mistakes, and they've gone on to do wonderful things in the future. You can't just stop something because you make a mistake and say, there's no way I'm going to take that chance again. Our society is consumed by risk management. It really is. I mean, my wife won't let the kid out of the house without a helmet on now. Shoot, I was all over the place with no helmet. I mean, I think it's a reflection of our society where people think that when something goes wrong, that it's all their fault, that there's no reason to go on from that point. And that's the further thing from the truth. They've done wonderful things as a nurse up to that point, and they're going to do wonderful things as a nurse later on. They just have to get through that rough spot. And if you just give it up then a whole future of helping people and making a difference and doing the positive thing is taken away. Once again, success is overcoming obstacles on the way to your dreams. If you're going to have a chance to be successful, you're going to have to bump into obstacles. I'm going to finish with John, the story about John. John was the first pick of the draft in 1983. I was the 310th pick of the draft in 1983. But despite that difference in draft status, we had a lot in common and a lot of discussions through the years. But the one I remember most was coming back from my last away game. I went through the entire season of 1994 knowing it was going to be my last season. And I had told the team at the start of the year that this was going to be it. I was going to retire after this. And it was a good way to go out. It was nice. I could say goodbye to the various stadiums and the guys and just kind of ease my way out of it. But it was a hard year. That was the Wade must go that year. I mean, it was a tough year. So we're flying back from San Francisco. The last game of the year. We just got beat by San Francisco. John is sitting, well, the way these flights are arranged is the coaches sit in the very front of the plane. The media and the people the coaches owe favors to, like the car dealers and guys like that, they're in the middle. And the players are in the back, youngest to oldest. So John and I are the two oldest. We're sitting in the very back, and John's sitting there. He's got an ice pack on his back because he had hurt his back earlier that year. And despite the injury, he still played because that's the kind of guy he was. And he had an ice bag on his knee, and his knee was a swollen mess. John tore his anterior cruciate in high school. Back then, they didn't know how to fix those. So he had played his whole high school, college, and pro career with that thing shifting back and forth and chewing up the cartilage. So by the end of every year, his knee was a swollen mess, and he had to ice it all the time. So he's sitting next to me, knowing that I was going to retire, and turned to me and said, Carl, I'm jealous. But he followed that up within 5 seconds by saying, but I've got to win a Super Bowl. That team was as far from a Super Bowl winning team as any I'd ever been on. The coach was about to be fired. Their best defensive player was retiring. And still, John knew where he was going. And he didn't say, I got to break Dan Marino's passing records. And he didn't say, I got to go to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He said, I got to win a Super Bowl. He had taken the team desire, the team passion, the team mission, and made it his own. That's what leadership is all about. If you can take that team passion, that team desire, that team mission, and make it your own, and express that to the people around you, and be clear and consistent with that, you're a leader. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. I'm in a room full of leaders, but that's leadership, the crux of leadership. The next year, the Broncos were 500. The following year, they had the best record in the NFL. They were 14-2, but they lost in the playoffs. The next year, they won the Super Bowl. And the next year, they won the Super Bowl again, and John was the MVP. And that happened because of his leadership, of his direction, of his passion, of knowing where he was going, even in his darkest hour. You have that same kind of power in your leadership position. Thank you so much for your attention.